Blog Talk Radio.
I am your host. At 11 o'clock Central Standard Time. And once again, as I said, this is Casey Grant, the host of The Fly Girl Show. Today, my guest is Lucy Macbeth. And as her website describes her, she is a mother, an activist, a speaker. And we have something in common. She is a retired Delta Airlines flight attendant. So, you know, once a flight attendant, always a flight attendant. But before I bring Lucy on the air today, I would like to introduce you to who she really is. Lucy Macbeth is the mother of Jordan Russell Davis. He was the 17-year-old who was killed in Jacksonville on November the 23rd, 2012, in Florida, at a gas station, and the reason was because his music was too loud. Now, I'm sure we've all been accused of having our music too loud, but what a tragic, tragic ending for this young man. So before I go into any more about that, I'm going to let Lucy tell her story because she is a remarkable woman. She's been really involved in being an activist ever since she was a little child. You didn't know I knew that, did you, Lucy? Good morning.
Good morning.
Yeah, no,
I didn't know that you knew that.
I tell you, you're going to go ahead and tell us your whole story, which I'm interested to sit back and listen like everyone else is. But your father is the one that introduced you, or I would say probably your parents, because he was involved in the NAACP. So therefore, as a child, you were attending different rallies and marches, and did you know what the heck was going on as a kid?
No, I did not. I just remember, you know, how busy my mom and specifically my dad were. I remember cocktail parties and gatherings at our house when we were children, and, you know, many, many people would be coming, and I knew a couple of them were attorneys and families of attorneys and things of that nature, but I never knew what mom and dad were doing. And those were all the convenings and the planning sessions for the NAACP, you know, for the marches and the rallies and everything. So I just remember distinctly, it was funny, I remember all of the cocktail glasses around when they would leave in the evening, you know, and all the cigarette butts and everything. I just knew something pretty important happened. We never knew. We were kind of put in the back seat of my dad's car, and, you know, we had pillows and blankets and coloring books and potato chips, and, you know, in Chicago it's Lay's potato chips. And so we would have those things with us, and we would just travel around with mom and dad as daddy was giving speeches and doing the work. And we just didn't know what it was for. I do remember, though, that my father was editor-in-chief of the Voice newspaper.
Oh, okay.
There in Illinois. Mm-hmm. So I remember downstairs in the basement, Daddy had the whole basement set up for doing nothing but writing and editing the newspaper, and he physically did it himself.
Oh, my goodness.
I remember him, physically cutting the articles and pasting and doing all of that before we have cut and paste, you know, digitally the way we have it now. But so I just didn't understand what my father did. But I knew that he was gone all the time. I knew pretty much that even as much as he left us as a family, you know, we were kind of stuck for the sake of civil rights. And I even asked my father as I got older, I remember sitting in his dental office and saying, Daddy, you know, you were never around. You were never there. And he said, you know, sweetie, he says, I know. And he says, I'm sorry for that. He said, but, you know, one thing I think that, you know, your mom and probably never married to civil rights. I became married to the NAACP.
So, oh, wow.
As I have gotten older now and have kind of began to pick up that mantle where my father left off, I understand.
I can imagine. Now, you're from Chicago.
I was born in
Chicago. Is that correct?
Mm-hmm. Yes. Illinois. I still have two younger sisters there that live in the city of Chicago, and I have cousins in Joliet.
Oh, okay then. Wow, I didn't know we had that connection. I really didn't know where you were from, but you live in Atlanta now.
Yes, mm-hmm. I live in the suburbs of Atlanta, Marietta, Georgia.
Okay. Wow. Well, okay. Well, now we've told the audience about your young child, your younger days. Kind of bring us up, obviously, from the point of you becoming an activist because of your son. So would you mind sharing that story with the audience?
I have, always been living here in Atlanta since I got married in 1989. Well, I moved to Atlanta in 1990 and had Jordan. Jordan was born and raised right here in Georgia, which most people don't know. Everybody thinks he's from Florida. But I was dealing with my second bout of breast cancer and, still trying to fly as a flight attendant and, go through the treatments and all of that. I didn't want Jordan to have to go through that with me.
Okay.
The first bout of breast cancer, he was really young, and so I didn't tell him, and he didn't know. But the second time, he was old enough, and I just figured I just didn't want him to have to suffer through that because the teenage years are very sensitive years, very sensitive years, and especially for male children, black male children. So
yeah.
I just thought, well, at this point, his father and I had decided that we would let Jordan go live with him. I had done all the formal raising and training. And so at 16, it was kind of time for his father to transition him into manhood. It had a really good relationship anyway because he'd spent summers and holidays and weekends with him, so he wasn't going to a stranger. And so we just decided it was best for Jordan to go stay with him while I went through my treatments. And in that time, that year and a half that Jordan was living with his father, that's when the tragedy occurred when, Jordan and his friends on November 23rd, 2012, which is the day after Thanksgiving, Black Friday, they were going shopping like everybody else in Jacksonville, shopping, but only, as teenagers do, as boys do, they were looking for girls, and so they were just going from mall to mall, and actually what happened is that they left one mall, and they were on their way to a second mall. They stopped at the gas station to get chewing gum, and the driver wanted to get cigarettes, and they wanted to get chewing gum because my son told them that their breath stinked and they needed to stop. If they were going to get girls, they needed to stop and get chewing gum. So in the time that they actually stopped, at 3.5 minutes, Michael Dunn, the killer of Jordan, drove and sat next to the boy in the parked his car next to them. And as teenagers do, they play loud music, they play it loudly, and they were playing rap, and they had every right to.
That is not a crime. No, that is not a crime.
Exactly. That's not a crime. So in that 3.5 minutes time that he pulled in there, his girlfriend gets out. She runs into the gas station to get a bottle of wine and potato chip. They had just come from his son's wedding. And so in that time that she goes into the store, Michael Dunn actually tells the boys, turn your music down. I can't think. And so then, Tevin, who's sitting in the passenger side in the front of the car, turns the music down. And Jordan, being Jordan, and I don't doubt that, we don't doubt that he said, no, turn the music back up. We're not bothering him. We're not doing anything wrong. We're playing music in our own car. Turn it back up. And so anyway, they turn the music back up. Michael Dunn, basically says, you can't talk to me this way. Pulls out his nine millimeter Glock gun out of his glove box and shoots 10 rounds into the car. Ballistics show that he was particularly aiming 3 of those rounds at Jordan, and those 3 rounds are actually what killed him. as the boys were trying to get out of the line of fire, backing out the car, Michael Dunn gets out of his car and he tracks them as if you're tracking, you know, like policemen do. They track the people that are running from them or what have you. He tracked them as their car was backing away. Then after he tracked them, shot 10 bullets into their car, he drives off. He goes back to his hotel with his girlfriend. They walk their dog. They order a pizza. They have a couple of stiff drinks, and they go to bed. And it's only once they recognized on the news that, you know, Jordan had been murdered, then what they did that next morning is they got in their car and they drove 170 miles back home and didn't call 911, pretended as if nothing happened. They went back to Satellite Beach, Florida. They parked their car in the garage and pretended like nothing happened. And the only reason why we're able to find out who Michael Dunn was is that there was a young homeless couple, and I will give his name, Sean Atkins, because this man has just, had it not been for him, we would not know to this day who gunned down Jordan. And Sean Atkins actually got the license plate number of Michael Dunn's car, wrote it down on a paper bag, and gave it to the representative at the register in the gas station. And that's the only way they were able to apprehend him, you know, the next morning in Satellite Beach, Florida. And so it took us 2 years to go through two trials. The first trial convening that we had, Michael Dunn was convicted of attempted murder for the three boys, but there was a hung jury on Jordan's charges of first-degree capital murder. So then we went back to court again 7 months later, and we received a guilty verdict for Jordan, first-degree murder.
Well, I want to ask a question, and I'm sure everyone has their mouths open as I do listening to the story. And by the way, I did see the movie, which is 3.5 minutes, 10 bullets. And I, before we go, I would definitely like for you to be able to tell people where they can go and view that, because that movie was so moving to me, and to be able to see the personalities of the young men. They were young boys, just typical boys, and looking for girls, as boys do, and for it to end so tragically, and for this person to have done this, and to have felt obviously no remorse, none.
Right. None. Absolutely none. And in his mind, you know, he believed he was protecting himself. He called the boys thugs. He said that they had a gun. It's absolutely not the truth. No guns, no drugs, no alcohol found on any of the boys, which, of course, we knew right away, you know, that was definitely not the truth, because they were good boys and they came from
exactly.
Two-parent households, you know, and their fathers were involved in their lives. So, you know, all the things that Michael Dunn espoused, you know, that he just automatically assumed before, because he saw four black males, you know, those were all misnomers, untruths, because he had no idea who they were. But because they were playing loud rap music and they didn't turn it down, he felt empowered with his gun and the law in Florida. He felt empowered to shoot, and he thought that he would really get away with it. He was actually very surprised, you know, just extremely surprised. I can't believe they're taking those four black boys' word over my word, because I've got the law that stands behind me and says that I can do this.
Well, I think that there's a big misunderstanding about that law. Stand your ground?
Yes.
Is that the proper name? I think we just have a misunderstanding about that. And for me, as a layperson, I just think it feels like it gives you the right to say anything you want to do and put it under the guise of, I was standing my ground to protect myself. I was in fear of losing my life. Now, how do you interpret that when you were still standing there in the middle of the day and you're shooting at the car as it's driving away?
Right.
I don't understand how, and maybe you could take two more seconds to tell us, how did the jury not come up with, why was it a hung jury over him being charged with murder?
Well, I mean, first and foremost, and this was something that was just so such a huge part of our trial. We were very concerned too with the implicit bias and the four boys being black teenagers and the assumptions that people have about black males anyway, and how those assumptions are played out by the gun violence that you see in Florida. We were very concerned about that with our jurors. And I guess the thing that threw them for a loop in the very first trial is one, to the assumption that, the boys had to be doing something wrong because they were black males. We do know specifically that there were two jurors in the very first trial that came in with their minds made up from the very beginning. They came in with their minds made up from the very beginning, stating that, and that's the reason why the jury was hung on Jordan's charge, is that there were two jurors that said absolutely, that Michael Dunn was not guilty. Michael Dunn was protecting himself. And a lot of that has to do with the stand your ground law, which is actually written into the jury instructions. Even though our trial, yes, even though our trial was never specifically deemed a stand your ground trial, which that has to be done by a judge. You have a separate hearing for that. Our case was considered a self-defense, common self-defense case, where you have a right to protect yourself if you feel that you're in imminent, danger or threat. And so, based upon that stand your ground verbiage, which is introduced into the jury instructions, which says that, well, okay, yes, you can defend yourself and you have no duty to retreat, even though it might be a perception of fear, not a credible threat. There was no gun, there was no alcohol, there was no drugs with the boys, but that didn't matter because, based upon the perception of fear, Michael Dunn has a right to protect himself and not back down. Well, so of course, all the lies that Michael Dunn gave on the stand, all the "I feared for my life," they had a shotgun, Jordan had a shotgun or a stick or something, I was in fear for my life, I was just protecting myself, and under the law I can do that. So those two jurors, they absolutely believed and concurred that that was Michael Dunn's story and that was the truth of the matter. So that was the reason why that first trial we did not get a conviction. When we went back the second time, we really kind of pushed our attorneys to express, one, premeditation, that it doesn't take any more than 3 seconds even to be considered premeditated murder. And two, that, there was no gun. There was nothing that would indicate to Michael Dunn that he was being threatened. Jordan never said anything threatening. Jordan never got out of the car, and that they were good boys. And so, it was more a matter, I think, of trying to appeal to the jurors as to who Jordan really was without even being able to show pictures. We couldn't show pictures in the courtroom of his family life. We could not call him a victim. We were told basically, Jordan's father and I were told that we couldn't show any emotion in the courtroom because they didn't want the jurors to be swayed. And so basically, you're adding insult to injury. We had to just sit there stoically,
And you're
while, you
absolutely
know,
right. That is definitely insult to injury. How could they have even, we don't know any of these things until we're put in the position of how degrading different things are. But who would ever have thought that they would tell you that you could not? This is your son.
Yeah, but that there again, they didn't want the jury to be swayed by us. So that's the reason why, Jordan was not even considered the victim. We couldn't show pictures of him, could show nothing of him, his family life, nothing. But of course, Michael Dunn, as the criminal, though, the criminals are the ones that have all the rights. The victims don't really have rights. He had all of his family pictures and just all those kinds of things. He had people come in and talk about what a great neighbor he was and fine, upstanding human being and all of that. But we could have none of that, nothing to attest to who Jordan or the boys were. The only thing that we could do is put those boys on the stand and let them tell their truth and let them be honest and let the world see that they are not thugs You know, they're not gangbangers. These were average black male teenagers just doing what teenagers do, playing loud music and shopping. And we had to appeal to the jurors that way because that's the only way that we could. That's the only way we could get people to understand the truth of who those boys were.
Well, I tell you, they did a very good job. In watching the movie, I was just so, it took me hours to really, to bring myself back up from that movie because they did a wonderful job. And they were truly just teenagers, you could tell. But if you don't mind, I have a caller on that wants to ask you a question. So just one moment while I bring this caller in, okay?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, here we go. So, hello there. Will you state your name, please, and if you have a question? Hello,
Hi,
caller.
Hello, can you hear me?
Yes,
can you hear me?
Yes, we can hear you.
Hi, Lucy and Casey. This is Sonia Jenkins. I just want to lighten the mood right now and to say both of you ladies are doing things. Lucy, I am so proud of you. You've been an advocate, and I am sure Jordan is smiling down from heaven, you know, with all the wonderful things you're doing. And, you know, his spirit lives on, and I am just so motivated. Just every time I see you on some forum, in some forum, whether it's just on television or hearing you on the radio, I get inspired just to have a purpose, just to have a purpose. And unfortunately, your purpose at this time had to come through pain, but I'm sure that Jordan is smiling down from heaven, and I just wish you so much success in your endeavors, and I'm just so proud of you.
Thank you. Thank you, and likewise, you too. I'm very proud of you, too.
Sure thing. So I don't really have a question. I just wanted to make that statement. You all can continue on. I'm enjoying listening to the show. It's very
well,
interesting.
Thank you. I tell you, she has, we have so much more information, but I really, really appreciate you calling in. I have one more caller, so allow me to hang up on you and get to the next caller. But thank you so much for taking the time to call in, Sonia.
Sure thing. You have a good one.
Okay, then let's take the next caller, Lucy, and see what this question is. And so this is caller number two. So hello there. Hello. Would you state your name and if you have a question for Lucy? Hello, caller. Okay. Well, I guess we lost that one. But we would just continue on then, Lucy, if you don't mind, then with the interview. And at that point, you were dealing with the trial and all the different, the do's and the don'ts that they instructed you. Now, how was the, and I don't want to give too much away about the movie, but the girlfriend also seemed really to play a big part and also for the verdict being the outcome that it was.
Yes, she did. And most people say, oh, if it hadn't been for her, we're so grateful and thankful to her. And I say, yes, I am grateful and thankful to her, but not because she was doing the right thing, because it was the right thing to do. She was basically saving her hide by, you know, because she was basically in collusion with him. She left the scene with him. You know, even though she knew he shot at some people, when she saw it on the news, she said, take me home. So then even as Michael Dunn says in his testimony, I wasn't worried about anything other than getting her home. I would deal with law enforcement later. So they drove back to Satellite Beach, yes, and they parked their car in the garage. They didn't call 911. They didn't talk to anybody. They pretended like it didn't happen. So basically, really, my concern in the very beginning of the trial was, why are we not prosecuting her? Why are we not going after her? And I had been assured by the law enforcement and detectives that she was cooperating. And, of course, they couldn't tell me what cooperating meant because they couldn't give out too much information to preserve the sanctity of, you know, the trial.
So, you know, I was extremely interested to see her testimony on the stand. And, of course, she did tell the truth. She did say that, you know, Michael Dunn never expressed to them that they expressed to her that the boys had a gun, that they shot at him, that they threatened him, none of that. And so basically she put all the, excuse my language, but bullet holes in his story, so to speak, discounting everything that he had said on the stand. And, you know, as I said in the movie, she was the one person that could really discount everything that he had said, you know, and so that the truth could come forth. And it did so. But not because it was the right thing to do. She never once ever said, I'm sorry for, you know, this happening to you. Or I think she, you know, just pretty much she was really trying to protect herself and not go to prison.
Oh, well, she seemed like a weak witness, but I was, you sit there on the edge of your seat and you want to pull more words out of her as she speaks, and she's definitely being very guarded as the movie depicts, but I'm glad she did. I'm glad she said what she said, because I think if they were ever not sure of how this case should have gone, with the young men testifying and with her testifying, it just also showed you how, to them, we have, you know, we all have the statement, Black Lives Matter. Well, lives matter also. And for them to go, and they were more concerned about the dog, and he was more concerned about her, than you to have stood there and emptied 10 bullets and more into a gun, into a car, and never had the decency to wonder, did you hit anyone, or should you be concerned? And then you just drive off as though nothing has happened. That just left me drained, emotionally drained.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and so then you can imagine how we felt, you know, because much of the story, you know, was not we weren't privy to much of the story, privy to a lot of the truth until we were actually sitting there in trial for the very first time, listening to all the intimate details of everything. And so it was just so, we were just absolutely mortified and so just pained and disheartened by the things that we were hearing coming out of his mouth. And of course, you know, Jordan's father and I had suspected that, you know, racism was a huge part of what we were dealing with. But of course, we're not going to push that issue. We didn't even have to talk about it because we knew in the end it would come out and we wouldn't even have to say anything about it. Because people kept saying, well, it's a hate crime, and you know, why aren't you talking about racism, and why aren't you talking about this as a, you know, racist situation? And we just said, because we don't have to. You know, we're not going to be the ones to badmouth him. We're not going to be the ones to say it. In time, it will come out. The truth will be revealed. And then we won't have to say it.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
No, you're absolutely right. It's always there. No matter how we try for it not to be, it's going to come back down to that situation. And judging people just because of the color, or just because there's more than one young Black man in the audience or in a group, now we've all labeled them as, which we are knowing now the new word is thug, and these were definitely not. How are these young boys doing, young men, because I'm sure they are there in college now, or what are they doing now? How have they been able to move on?
Well, as you know, anything like this is extremely psychologically as well as spiritually and physically stressing to them, and they're still suffering from, you know, stressors from the shooting and also, you know, the two trials. Some of the boys have had counseling under the state of Florida. The Victims Advocate group allows, you know, compensation for counseling and things of that nature. And they've had some. I'm not aware if they're still in counseling at this moment, but I do know that they're all having some problems. They're all showing symptoms of the post, you know,
traumatic
stress.
Sure.
Mm-hmm. Each of them, and honestly, this is a burden that they will carry for the rest of their lives.
They're very skittish. They do not want to talk to media outside of us. And they very rarely make any public appearances for media or anything of that nature. If there's something that we're doing in Jacksonville, they will come and appear with us, but they won't talk to the media. They don't want to be seen on television. You know, they're still afraid. And I think in light of everything that continues to happen to young black males in this country, you know, they have reason and cause to be.
Yeah. So
it's just so disheartening that, you know, they carry the burden. And then too, they ask, well, why am I still here?
Yes. Yes. Survival guilt.
Right.
Yes. You know, that was one of the questions that when I, as I said, I came home and it took me hours just to kind of, I was so emotional. I have nephews and I look and it's so simple. Their lives are just taken away for no reason whatsoever. And that we all live in fear, and particularly young black men. And I'm sure these men, as they get older and more mature, I'm sure they're going to find their own voice. I bet you they will become activists in some kind of way later on as they mature. But they have to heal themselves first, and my prayers are with them. And I'm sure they call you to make sure you're okay.
You know, I don't hear from them as often, but usually if I, you know, come into Atlanta, there's an event or media or what have you, they'll come. They'll show up just to say hi, or you know, they say, hey, Mom, how are you doing, Mom? You know, I love you, Mom. You know, that kind of thing. And, you know, I'm just very, very concerned about them emotionally, concerned about their welfare. But, you know, they have good families. They have good parents. So they're not out here on their own. They have a very good support system, and they always have had a very good support system, good family, and, you know, a solid upbringing. So, you know, they're in pain.
Well, we'll continue to pray for them because their recovery is going to be long and endless, actually. I think this is going to be something they'll carry with them for the rest of their lives. And with that, let's kind of move on to some activities that you're still doing, because you are one busy, busy, busy woman. And give us some of these things. One of the programs that you're involved with is you are the national spokeswoman for... What is it now? Give me the full title. What is that you are the national spokeswoman for?
I'm a national spokesperson for Everytown for Gun Safety and Moms Demand Action for Gun Sense in America. And basically what we are the Everytown for Gun Safety is the umbrella organization for Mayors Against Illegal Guns and Moms Demand Action for Gun Sense in America. These two organizations have grafted together, and under the umbrella of Everytown for Gun Safety, we are now the largest nonpartisan grassroots gun violence prevention organization in the country. We have a chapter in every state. We have over 2.7 million online supporters. We have over 700 gun violence victims in our survivor network. We have a very extensive survivor network of individuals that are victims of gun violence. They are actually the voice of our organization. They are the ones that go and talk to our legislators and our civic leaders and community faith leaders. They go with us to Washington for press conferences. They, you know, to all the state legislatures across the country, they're testifying along with, you know, our established lobbyists, and they are the voice of gun violence, domestic violence abusers, you know, the number one way that women are killed with guns in is with guns by domestic violence, you know, situations. We work on background check legislation, which they actually work with us on. And also child access prevention. We have a campaign called Be Smart, because what we're finding is that most of the children that are being hurt with guns in their households are simply because the parents have not properly secured those guns in the household. So all of our victims, our survivor network, are extremely impactful and important to the work that we do, and we're really making some good inroads.
And can you give us the website for that information for those that would like to go on and read and also join? Because I signed up for it, and I would love to, and I hope that they will be having some type of activity soon, because, you know, we have a terrible problem in Chicago. And I know every time you listen to it, you just cringe, because all the work that you're doing is definitely something that needs to be done. And all of us, whether we're a victim of any of this, we need to be aware. We need to be involved. We need to know the laws and protest. We need to become more active in being active about improving the safety of all of us, our children, our lives, all of us.
Absolutely. Yeah, I mean, this is, it's a matter of preserving the sanctity of our own lives, you know, Black human lives and all lives. So if you're interested in becoming a part of the process, I always say that, you know, you don't have to do what I do, but everyone does have a voice, and everyone can be involved in the process of gun violence prevention, specifically within your own community. You can go to everytown, everytown, everytown.org, or momsdemandaction.org. And on these two websites, we have toolkits. And what I mean by toolkits is these are established ways for you to get involved, even if it's just making a phone call to your local and state legislators. What we do, we've already done all the work for you. And so you just plug in your name and your zip code, and your state legislator comes up. We have pre-prepared tweets for you, pre-prepared Facebook messaging for you, since, you know, a lot of our work is done with social media. And if you want to make phone calls, we have those pre-prepared scripts for you. There are ways that you can be involved, and you can do it over and over and over again. So when people say, well, I don't know how to get active, I don't know how to help, this is a very viable, easy way. But the most important way, and I stress this more than anything else, is that you have to be aware within your own legislatures, your own communities, what gun laws are being passed. You have to do your research, because every state, these really horrible gun laws are being passed that allow these kinds of shootings to happen. So once you know what is happening within your state, you've got to understand and know what legislators are pushing these gun laws. And mm-hmm. those are the ones that you have to make sure that when you go to the polls, and you must go to the polls, because all of this work is done at the polls. Most of these gun laws are pushed through at the state legislatures, not the federal elections. This is at the state and local elections. So once
that's important. You just said, yes, to be informed, to realize what level. I think that's very important. And repeat that website slowly one more time. I just want to make sure everyone heard those websites. Please do that again.
It's everytown.org. Every town is one word, and momsdemandaction.org.
Okay, perfect. Well, I think, yes, education is the key to everything. And what you don't know, you just don't know. But we have to be informed, and we can sit around and we complain and we turn the TV on Mondays and go, oh, what a shame, but you still are removed from it until it affects you personally. But before it affects you, let's fight constructively for maybe to lessen that possibility of it really affecting your family. So we cannot walk around and not vote. You have to vote. Presidential vote, any other thing, anything that's important to our lives, we must be informed and we must vote.
Absolutely. And that is really the key. Most people think that, you know, the laws that are enacted on the federal level mirror the laws on the local level, and that is not the case. At the state level, you know, states have the authority to create, you know, their own laws. They do it all the time. They amend sometimes the federal laws. They amend them and tweak them to fit, you know, what they want to do or convene in their own states. And that's where we're finding the problem with the gun laws, is that each of the states, particularly with the Stand Your Ground laws, they are tweaking them to the point now that, like, I was in Nevada, and I was testifying before the Nevada state legislature there, because they already have Stand Your Ground on their books. But what they were going to do is broaden that Stand Your Ground by automatically assuming that the shooter is justified. They were going to put that caveat in their Stand Your Ground law, that the shooter, that the shooter's automatically justified, you know.
Excuse me. I have to interject that, because those two words are just really, I'm cringing. Automatically assume
that they're justified in having done what they've done.
That's terrible. How can you automatically assume anything? Oh my goodness. I'm sorry, I'm just too, that alone has really upset me most, along with everything else that you're telling me. But automatically assume that you had a right, that is just, you're behind the eight ball before you even get started.
Exactly, yeah. So these are the kinds of things that we are really dealing with. People, and the thing that saddens me, though, is that most people within their own states have no idea what's happening with state politics, with state laws. They really have no idea. And that's so dangerous. It's so completely dangerous that we are unaware of the laws, the gun laws and specifics that are being passed behind closed doors. Most of this legislation is all pre-prepared by the NRA. And the NRA has a very conservative, right wing
following
agenda.
The agenda,
right.
Yes.
Yeah, and the agenda is to place a gun in every household in the country.
Yes.
Their agenda is to make sure that all the laws are broken down such that you can use your gun anywhere you want, any way you want. They want absolutely no restrictions on gun usage or gun ownership. I will tell you, the ALEC, which is the American Legislative Exchange Council.
Well, now, Lucy, too, let me bring this in, that you were invited to the White House by President Obama, unveiling the Brothers Keeper Initiative for Minority for Young Men. Now, and also you had a private viewing of your movie, 3.5 Minutes, 10 Bullets. Is that correct?
Yes.
And that was recent.
That was recent. I actually go to Washington quite a bit and work with the White House quite a bit now. And it's such an honor and a blessing to be able to do that. Yes, our film, 3.5 Minutes, 10 Bullets, is being used basically as a kickoff and a starter kickoff for a lot of the work that's being done with the White House and other associated organizations that are working with that White House for mass incarceration, policing, and gun violence.
Okay.
And so they were using our film for viewing with legislators, civic leaders, police, and also some scientists, researchers, to really kind of hone in on the problems with our laws, implicit bias, and gun violence.
Okay. Okay. And where can someone go to view this?
Well, the film has already made its national viewing around the country, and it's been traveling in film festivals. But now it is actually going to be on television on HBO November 23rd, which is the anniversary of Jordan's death. HBO has purchased the rights to it. So now it will actually be on television November 23rd. I'm not sure what time yet. Then also, too, the film, when we created the film, we wanted it with the expressed inclusion of being able to use it as a teaching tool, as a tool for civil impact. And so the film does travel around to colleges and universities and faith communities. And there's a curriculum, a faith curriculum for pastors that goes with the film, as well as one for academia. So those two curriculums actually are part of the screenings of the film. And so now we're to the point where we're starting to have other organizations and institutions around the country that are actually beginning to screen the film themselves. And I know the PICO network, which is Pastor Mike McBride, that's a huge network in the country. They are using the film exclusively. We travel around with PICO Network now in showing the film to faith-based communities.
Okay, well, it's a very moving, and I put it on my Facebook and my website and everything else to try to promote it, because it is a very, very moving and informative movie. I really enjoyed it, so I'm glad it is being touched and being viewed in all these different places and avenues that you've just expressed. And one of the other positive things that you have done, which one of many, but one of the other things is that you have a scholarship, Walk with Jordan Scholarship Foundation, and that provides charitable and educational assistance to graduating high school students, which is really a good thing, that are attending traditional as well as technical training colleges and universities. And so how and where can we get information about that to be able to contribute?
And thank you so much for asking that, because most people don't know that I live here in Atlanta. And so, you know, we have been giving scholarships to students. You can go onto the website, which is walkwithjordanfoundation.org, walkwithjordanfoundation.org. We are a 501c3. We've been in existence for 2 years now. This foundation was basically started because of the conversations that I had with Jordan once he moved to Jacksonville. He was really concerned about the lack of education that he was receiving there versus what he received here in the Atlanta area. And all the students that he said, Mom, they're just as smart. These students are just as bright. They're just as intelligent here, but because they're going to inferior schools, never going to get the scholarships. They're never going to get access to Ivy League schools. And when we actually ended up going to get Jordan's high school diploma at his graduation ceremony, I saw that. There were hardly any students at all that were going to be going outside of community colleges. I could count maybe 3 students that were going to go to Ivy League schools that were graduating, and a lot of kids were never going to go on to college. So I created the Scholarship Foundation to kind of educate those very same kids that Jordan was concerned about, and not just in Jacksonville, but all over the country. But I do actually run my scholarship through, it's called Valor Academy in Jacksonville. It's a single male gender charter school. And so I have infused my scholarship through there, through that academy, and also 100 Black Men of Tallahassee, currently working on trying to infuse the scholarship into an organization here in Atlanta. But you can go online, and any student can apply. They take the Myers-Briggs assessment, personality assessment, because we want them to kind of understand what they may be better suited for. If we give you the money, we don't really want you to throw the money away. We also offer mentorship for them. We are a safety net. We are supporting them from beginning to end, because a lot of students don't have support at home as to how do they apply, you know, or what can they apply for, what scholarships or what grants and loans can they apply for, and what should I study, and what schools are the best schools for me to go to. So we offer those kinds of support to them, as well as for students that want to just go to trade schools, or students that just don't even want to go to college and they want to be entrepreneurs. We have, mm-hmm. My chairman, he does that. He does that mentoring for entrepreneurs because he himself is one. So we want to give the students more support than just giving them the money. That's not enough. And we want to make sure that we support them all, all the way. My goal, my dream is to be able to fund them for the full 4 years or 2 years. Not to that point yet, but we're getting there. So it's Walk with Jordan Scholarship Foundation, walkwithjordanfoundation.org. And we're based here in Atlanta. Our office is here in Atlanta. And we're looking forward to really being able to really help educate our kids.
Well, I think that's one. That's a great plus for the scholarship, because you're absolutely right. Scholarships are handed out, and if you're not equipped to handle all the different things and you have no resources, then you don't really at times enjoy the full potential of the scholarship and the opportunities. So I'm glad that you have reached out and gone beyond just awarding. Years ago, the flight attendants, Delta flight attendants, a bunch of us got together, and we had an organization called Asante Wa, and we did the same thing. We did not care. All we needed is that you had a desire to go to school, whether it was a trade school or whatever. We, at that point, you had to write an essay. That's why. That's how you got accepted with us. It wasn't your grade point average. It was you writing an essay as to your dreams and your desires. And then a group of us, the panel, they met, and then we were awarded. And we met with the person, and we evaluated, and we stuck with them for the first couple of years, and they were able to, they had sisters. We all became like their big sister, or and men and young men, to help them along with this process, because you can't grab my hand and help me and then get me to the finish, or get me to the line and then let me go and don't help me get to the finish line. So I really like what you do with that foundation, and I really wish you luck in anything that I can do to help promote it. Please let me know, because I would definitely put it on the website, and we'll have to bring you back so that you can talk about the foundation and how well things are doing sometime later on. But I don't know when we'll catch you again, because this was a wonderful treat to get you today. You are just driving and running all over the place.
Well, I will tell you, we have a couple of events that are coming up here in Atlanta. I'm trying to really start spending more time here in my own backyard. It's important to me that I take care of my own backyard. I know I do it nationally, but it's important to be here. And October 4th at the Civil, here in Atlanta, well, anyway, in Atlanta, it's the Civil and Human Rights Museum, the new one. We're going to actually have a screening. Yeah, we'll have a screening of the film here in Atlanta at that museum. And then also we'll be here. And then, let's see, what else? We're actually taking the film to Vancouver. We're making arrangements now, hotel arrangements and everything. It's actually making its international appearance. So the film will be there too. But we're really starting to just, you know, broaden our perspectives with the work that we're doing, and trying to make sure that we make some social impact, but more than anything, awaken the country to what's happening with implicit bias and racism and gun violence. That is our mission.
Now, can they go on your website, which is, if I have it correct, is LucyMacbeth.com. Is that correct? That is your website?
Right. LucyMacbeth.com.
And, okay, so for those that are listening, they can go on your website, and will there be a schedule of events? Because the one in Atlanta, I'd love to be able to attend. What date was that? Or should I just go on your website, like I'm instructing everyone else to do, and follow you so that anybody can find out where you are in the different cities?
Yes, you actually can. I have an administrator who puts everything on the website. I just send him the dates, and he puts everything on there for me. But October 4th here in Atlanta at the Center for Civil and Human Rights at 2:30 p.m. Is the screening of film. And so I invite everyone to come that's interested in coming. And then we'll also, you know, have a panel discussion afterwards. And we'll continue to do these kinds of things throughout the country. We may actually bring the film back through Chicago again. Hopefully we will. We're just taking the film wherever anyone wants it to come. Basically, we're using it as a tool and a means to really educate people and to really create some impact around the country, because we have to save our sons. We have to save our communities.
We have to save our sons and we have to save our communities. I mean, those are profound words. I'm going to see, since, you know, Sonia is our mutual friend, I'm going to put that on her agenda, ask her to put that on her agenda and see if we both can come in October the 4th and support you, support the cause, support the film. So if we, when you hear people in the audience going, "Lucy, Lucy," it'll be us.
Okay. I look forward to hearing that. Thank you.
Yeah, it'll be so we will definitely, yeah, we'll get in contact with you ahead of time and hopefully then you have a little quiet time with you, because I enjoyed the discussion, the open panel discussion after the movie in Chicago, and there were some very interesting questions. There was a lot of, I'm sure, venting. One woman in particular, she had lost her son, and she didn't go into real detail about the circumstances, but the pain was still there. But she was had some relief when she was able to relate to it and to correspond with you. I don't know if you remember that particular woman, but she gave you very high praises for doing such a wonderful job in bringing awareness to all of us. And I give you high praises. I just think that, oh, you have gotten put in a situation that you are really doing a great job in educating us and speaking very well as a, what do we call you, partner in crime as far as being retired from the airline. I am just, you know, extremely proud of what you are doing. And in any way, if I can help, I'd love to be involved and help you. So call me. Let me know. If there's something you want to say on the radio show, we can schedule another interview, and you can just spread the word on whatever it is you would like us to be informed or updated on.
And I want to thank you very, very much, Casey. Thank you so much for allowing me this much time to just chat with you today. Really express the truth of, you know, what happened with our story and what's happening in our community. You know, giving me the platform to do that means a lot to me. And you're making an impact too. Definitely so.
Well, I tell you, retirement is fine because you can do all these wonderful things that you didn't think you could do or never had an interest. And it's all self-fulfilling. I'm enjoying it. And hopefully one day when you settle, you'll be able to read stars in the sky, and that will put a little smile on your face as you walk down that memory lane of all the wonderful times that you had, because you flew for how many years, was it? Hello?
Can you hear me?
Wow. Okay, now I can hear you. I can hear you. Did you hear me? How many years did you fly?
A good 30 years. 30 years.
Wonderful.
Really good.
30 years.
Delta was a great company to work for.
Yes, yes. Oh, I agree with you. I definitely agree with you. I think that Delta is definitely one of the best companies in the world as far as we are concerned. So, yes, sirree, but they have our vote. Well, I tell you, I'm going to let you go, and I really enjoyed this interview, and I'm sure we're going to get a great response from those that did, you know, tune in today. And so, Lucy, I will let you start your day, and thank you so much for being on the show.
Thank you so much. God bless.
God bless. Oh, my goodness. I hope that everyone enjoyed that show. I am still emotionally involved in it because it was such an emotional subject. But tune in next week when I hope to have another education or enlightening program on the Fly Girl Show. Host, Casey Grant. And the number for you to call in is 347-857-3609. I hope that you will tell your family and your friends to tune in at 11 o'clock Central Standard Time as we have another wonderful show. Once again, that number, 47-857-3609. And I'll see you next week. This is
you.